Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Today's program was brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Grace Bonney, and you are listening to After the Jump. Today, I'm speaking with the founders of A Kind, a website devoted to celebrating limited edition designs and the designers behind them. We're coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn today, and you can listen live every Monday at 12 p.m. at heritageradionetwork.org or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Of A Kind was founded in November of 2010 by college friends Claire Mazur and Erica Cerullo. Since its launch, Of A Kind has worked with up-and-coming designers to create and sell limited edition exclusive designs like bags, t-shirts, and jewelry, and they've worked with a pretty impressive range of designers like Tucker, Claire Vivier, Caitlin Motion, Partners in Spade, and Bagu. So I'm really happy to have a full house here today at the radio station. We've got Claire, Erica, and Lindsay from Of A Kind, along with my partner in crime, Amy Azarito from Design Sponge. So thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us.
So Of A Kind has, more quickly than any other site I've ever read, very honestly become my favorite site in the entire world.
Wow.
We were really, and this is, I'm, it's, Amy knows, I'm a bit obsessive about it, so I'm very excited to talk with you guys today. I think, and this is a little bit embarrassing, I think I've bought probably every like fourth thing that you guys release. And how many new designs do you release a week?
Three a week now. We started out with one a week.
So I could basically outfit myself in Of A Kind, yeah. From headwear to earrings to, have you even done shoes yet, right?
No, it'll be really complicated, but we really want to. We've talked about doing it with Osborne or Dieppe Restrepo would be some dream.
Yeah.
I'm wearing those now. That was
sizing is scary. Yeah.
At some point you're going to have to start selling like closet organizers, and then I can just have all of that organized.
That's what we need.
So I was reading about how you guys met online, but I'd love for you to tell everyone listening a little bit about how you guys started. We were talking before about how a mutual frenemy introduced you at the University of Chicago. So take us back and tell us how it all started.
Yeah. So we met, Claire always says our freshman year of college, but it was really her freshman year of college, my sophomore year of college. And we were introduced by this friend of ours, Rush, who is just like a wonderful character. And he decided to introduce us because Claire was dating a basketball player. And my freshman year, I had dated a basketball player. So clearly we had a lot in common.
And it was, Erica became sort of like a big sister figure to me in college. Like she said, she was a year older than me. And we just stayed really good friends out throughout college. We were on the major activities board together. I think it's a really funny name now because there was no minor activities board.
And this was at University of Chicago.
We put on concerts together. So that was a big sort of like production focused activity we did together. I worked on something called Festival of the Arts, which was my other big sort of project in college. And I think both those things were about sort of managing artists and producing big events and putting together these huge creative projects, which I think has fueled a lot of what we do now.
Totally. And I had a column for the like Chicago paper, the school paper, about things to do in Chicago, which was like sparked my interest in editorial and the whole editorial world. So then when we moved to New York, we both moved to New York after graduation, and I got a job in magazines eventually at Details. And Claire went to school for arts management at Columbia. Yeah. And we were really close friends, and we always bounce ideas off each other, and we're really sort of impressed and blown away by people who had done their own thing. And I remember a conversation we had at one point about the girls who started the restaurant Sorella in the Lower East Side, who were about our age. And it was like, we were just like, this is the coolest thing. And all of these big name chefs are going in to check out their restaurant. And that just feels so special. And it's so amazing that they can have this ownership over this project.
So I was in school, like Erica said, for arts management, because I was really fascinated by the idea and excited by the idea of acting as a support system for artists and helping people who thought creatively to realize their projects from logistical standpoints, from financial standpoints, and sort of marketing standpoints as well. And so I'd gone to school for that and been a little bit disappointed because effectively it, what I was studying at that time was non-for-profit management, because that's so much of what arts management has become. And the one thing that really excited me while I was in school was a company called 20 by 200, started by Jen Beckman. And she became this total hero for me. And I thought, this is what the future of arts management is about. It's about taking the internet and leveraging it to sort of disrupt these systems that have been in place forever and give artists an opportunity to market and produce their work without having to go through this gallery system that's really closed and insular. And so I applied for a job there like three times at least.
And 20 by 200 is a site that sells limited edition art prints, and the starting price at the time was $20.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, she was doing something really disruptive on both sides, which was giving artists an opportunity to sell their work and to market their work, again, without galleries. And at the same time, giving collectors an opportunity to buy art without having to walk into an art gallery and drop $1 zillion and have connections to gallerists. And so that was just so exciting for me. And that was, and it was like, I remembered what got me excited about working with artists and working in that field. And so I was applying, I had gotten my master's, I'd been working for a couple of years, and I was applying to be her personal assistant. And so the cover letter was
that's
like,
how hardcore she was.
Yeah. So the cover letter was like, I will do anything that I can to work for you because I think you're changing the world. And I sent it to Erica, who has a pretty decent sense of propriety. And I was like, is this so nuts? Is she going to like take out a restraining order on me? So we started sort of bouncing the idea back and forth about why 20 by 200 works and what's so special about it, and getting really sort of philosophical about it, I think. And that's where the idea came out that, could we do the same thing? Could we take this model and apply it to emerging fashion designers who are up against so many of the same challenges and hurdles that emerging artists are up against? And Erica, coming from the editorial world, brought this really key idea to it that you have to tell the story.
And I mean, I think there are a couple of things that sort of came into play there. You know, one, with 20 by 200, you're asking people to put down $20 basically to invest in an artist and give them a try, and you pretty much have a sense of what you're getting. With emerging designers, we were asking people at the low end to spend, you know, $80, at the high end, a couple hundred dollars on an artist they've never heard of. And it felt like, to really get people to make that investment, to take that chance, you really have to tell the story. You really have to create that sense of connection. And on the other side of things, you know, I was working in the magazine industry at a time when magazines that people loved were folding, Domino and Gourmet, and magazines that people are like, oh my God, like I have every issue for the last 15 years. And clearly people were buying things that were being written about in those magazines, but the magazines themselves weren't seeing enough ad revenue to keep them up. So it just seemed like, why not break down that publisher-editor wall and just sell the things that we were writing about and write about the things we really believed in?
And it just worked so well, too. And I think what we were doing, for a lot of reasons, one, these designers are also hungry to have their story told. And also because it enhances the e-commerce experience so much. And we had both been buying online, and, you know, I think probably even before it had really become a more commonplace thing. But you know that it's such an anonymous, impersonal experience. And part of the joy of shopping, which is such an inherently emotional act, is having that conversation with the shopkeeper and finding out where where something's from, who made it. And, you know, that enriches it so much. And so if you can add the story while to the e-commerce experience, it's almost, you know, sort of bringing the person out from behind the cash register and having them tell you the story. And I think in e-commerce, you're always asking someone to make a real leap of faith, whether that's, you know, that you don't know the designer, or you haven't felt the thing, or, you know, you don't know the quality of it. And when you're not working with brands that people know and sort of are familiar with the fit or familiar with the quality of the goods, it becomes even more important. So it all really felt like it worked so well together. And also, I think, sort of brought together a lot of ideas that were becoming really exciting at that moment. So one being this idea of conscientious consumption and wanting to know where your food is from and who's making your clothes and all of that, and something that we saw our peer groups really sort of getting excited about. And also the idea of being an early adopter and hearing about a band before everybody else did, and eating at a restaurant before everyone else knew about it. And that same thing sort of applied really well to discovering a designer before they were really big. And Eric and I had both had that experience of buying from young designers and seeing them rise to success and getting really excited about having had a piece before they
and
were
having that deal. Sort of possession of them, of being exactly. Like, I bought from Lulu Frost when I, you know, bought something from her out of her apartment. Right. I went to pick it up at her apartment.
You feel so the cool sense of ownership. And our tagline, which we are really fond of, is know and own. And it's like that idea of like you get to know somebody and you own an object from that, but you also feel a sense of ownership because you knew them before everybody else did, and that gives you like a special right or something to them.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things I love so much is the roster of designers that you work with. I'd love to know how many of those designers or products were set up prior to the launch. Did you have a whole bunch of them in the queue? No.
Like 8, maybe not. I mean, we definitely had a lot of conversations, but we didn't know before we launched. We had no idea how many of any piece we should order. We had no idea if it was going to work at all. So January of 2011 was a total
really
scramble.
Like, yeah. Erica Weiner saved our lives by being like, sure, I'll give you this necklace in a week. Because we didn't know, and we had no idea how it was going to work. And we built our business very much with that idea of like, we don't know what's going to catch on. We don't know if the limited edition thing is going to be what does it for everyone. Or maybe it's the storytelling part. Or maybe it's the fact that it's emerging designers. Who knows what part of this is really going to work. So let's not put all our eggs in any one of those baskets. Mm-hmm. So by the time, once we got through the holidays, we were like, oh, we have to keep going. Who can make things really quickly for us? And we were lucky enough that one of the first things we started doing when we were planning was just cold emailing designers, who amazingly were really responsive. And looking back, it was like some of the ones that we were most excited about were the most responsive, which is really funny because you expect that they were the ones who would be like, who's this person emailing me from a Gmail address? Yeah. With this like,
welcome to my life.
Yeah. We like overthought everything. I shouldn't even admit this. We had people sign, designers who we met with in the beginning sign NDAs.
Oh, like completely shameful. Like yeah. as if they're going to go start this thing or go tell their
friends.
Right,
exactly.
Yeah. I have to say, I actually think that's really smart. I think it's a weird business. And I think especially in the design industry, it never hurts to be safe. But
we were reading Design Sponge a lot when we started with the Biz Ladies stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think you guys are a really wonderful example of that. I mean, I love that you're citing Jen Beckman as such a big influence. I think it's really important for women to have examples of other women and in a huge range of ages that are doing things on their own and not just starting businesses, but starting businesses that are the change they want to see. And I know that sounds a little kumbaya, but it's really important that if you see something that's missing in whatever industry you're in, that you take the time to form that. Yeah. And I love that you guys did that. And you did it, according to your website, you did it in 12 hours over the course of 25 years.
That's one of the things that still, Lindsay knows, she's sitting here, our press girl who's been with the PR, director of communications, who's been with us since pretty much day one. I resurface that email all the time because it's so awesome to me, because we literally was one of those things where you're rapid fire back and forth emailing all night being like, what about this? And what if we did this? And that was the first seed of the business. And you look back and it describes
it
exactly what we're doing now.
Yeah. I mean,
and
it really holds up.
It's just so inspiring to me because it proves true that like these ideas that you hash out over email one night in the middle of the night can become this huge thing that are all of a sudden the center of your life.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think you guys were fortunate to come to that situation with experience that ended up being really valuable. I think it's really interesting that you both have a background in dealing with artists directly, both editorially and dealing with management. How did that affect the way that you set up the working relationships with your artists? What were the things that you knew were missing that needed to be in your business to make the relationship more effective?
I think, what naturally became obvious really quickly was that we knew our customer better than a designer ever could. And, in the beginning, we didn't necessarily know that, but that became really obvious that, you could have a designer saying, look, I love this thing and it's so amazing and I think it's the best
this
thing.
This backless dress.
Yeah, this backless dress that's in this, color that's not going to translate on screen at all, but it's so beautiful.
This nude dress is perfect.
And so, it became obvious really quickly that we had to balance what we knew about trying to sell things online, which is really challenging, and also, and just knowing our customer, having to balance that with the designer's enthusiasm and passion for certain pieces, which sometimes aligns and sometimes doesn't align at all. And so that's been an ongoing thing, really learning how to communicate with designers and saying, I love that thing too. It's awesome. It is not going to sell online. You can't sell something that women can't wear a bra with online, because if you can't wear a bra with it, you want to try it on and know what it looks like.
And if it's a color of flesh, you want to know if it is a color of your flesh.
Right. Or like. Exactly.
And I mean, I think on the storytelling side of things, a lot of the designers that we work with wanted their stories to be told, and a lot of them have been written about in small ways in a lot of magazines, and it's the same 120-word blurb written over and over again. And it says the same things. And they love the idea of sharing more. And I think for most of them, the idea of sharing more themselves through their own websites or through their own blogs was really daunting. And how do you tell that story? And what are people interested in? And so I think having the process that we do, where we sort of sit down and have a really sort of like informational background interview, and then flesh out story ideas with the designers, and the designers have to be completely on board with it, and then shaping the stories from there, works really well for everybody.
In the beginning, when we weren't so crazy stressed, I had the pleasure of sitting in on some of the interviews that Erica did with the designers, and what I thought was really exciting and I think gave me an even increased confidence in my business partner was that so many designers would be like, I don't really have any stories to tell. I'm not that interesting. And Erica always would be able to identify these really compelling stories. And I think what was really interesting about it, too, was that she never felt compelled that the story had to be about the product specifically or even the process specifically, but to tell a story about a designer's childhood growing up in skate parks actually does relate back to who the designer has become now and the product that they're making now, and that can be really interesting and that audiences want to know that. And of course the designer would say, well, this isn't relevant at all, but you know, I skated when I was a little kid. And it's like, actually no, give me more of that. And I think that's a real talent and something that I love about the stories that we tell on the site.
And I mean, that's amazing, right? Because if you're a girl who was also like the one girl at the skate park growing up, you suddenly feel compelled to buy this silk scarf that this person made in a way that you totally didn't before.
Because it's about the human experience and connecting. And that, again, is something we always started with, this idea of like, let's see what it does if we stop thinking about designers as producers and start thinking of them as artists. And how does that change the consumptive experience?
And also as people. I mean, I think that is something we definitely strive for, to give people access to a person who is accessible, who lives in an apartment, who probably works by themselves, instead of it being like, you know, designer and like a big white box studio that's so fancy that's completely removed from your world.
Exactly. Well, you guys have done a lot to really enhance that relatability of artists and sort of breaking down that wall between the buyer and the buyee. So we're going to take a quick break. Cool. And when I come back, I'm going to ask you lots of things about which pieces you actually own.
Okay.
Market. We review each and every product that hits our shelves. Our cleaning products are no exception. Our EcoScale ranking system rates each household cleaner so you know what you're getting. Now, during Earth Month and any time of the year, learn more at WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to After the Jump. I am here with the founders of ofakind.com. We're recording live at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You can listen to us every Monday at noon on heritageradionetwork.org, or you can download the podcast at iTunes. So before the break, we were talking about the founding of A Kind, and now I want to talk a little bit about some of the details that go into the business. We're all, I know Amy and I are really curious to know how you actually find the people that you work with. I know a lot of them are in New York, and we're all obviously in New York, but what's your process for finding the artists?
Forwarding each other emails being like, have you seen this thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I think the one thing, Claire and I don't have the same style by any stretch, but I think we're drawn to the same aesthetics, which has made that process really easy. We never have this case where it's like, I'm obsessed with something, and she's like, really? which is amazing. And I think what we found since the very beginning when we started reaching out to designers, when we were cold emailing them in like early 2010, is that the designers are so interconnected, and not just the designers in New York, but the designers all around the country. So it's like, we had the first time we met the designers from Ace and Jig, who we love, we had dinner with them and we were talking to them and they were like, oh, like we just bought hats from Annie Larson, who at the time was in Minnesota and just recently moved to Brooklyn. So there's this whole sort of cross pollination mm-hmm. that happens.
Yeah, they all, it's funny in the community that if they haven't met each other yet, it's like they're 1 degree away from meeting each other. And yeah, and we love seeing them all hang out. And they hadn't met Annie Larson yet, but then Annie Larson moved to New York and they started hanging out, and seeing it on Instagram was like, yay.
Look at what's happening.
It's yeah. the Instagram connection. Yeah. So how involved are you guys in the design process, or are you involved at all in what gets picked and designed?
Very. It ranges from the most straightforward being somebody saying, I made this as part of my regular collection, but then I decided not to sell it to anyone. Would you like it as an exclusive? Or, you know, I have this, but I haven't released it yet. Would you guys like it? To starting from total scratch and saying, hey, you know, I think it would really make sense for us to do a hat from you because I think that really exemplifies your aesthetic. And I think something really bold and graphic. And then they come back with a couple sketches and you say, okay, I like this one. Can we do it in green? And then they send it back to you in a green cashmere and you're like, okay, but we're not going to be able to sell it for that much money. And so can we maybe try out a wool instead? And so that's, I think, you know, the most collaborative that it gets. And that's probably actually when it's like most fun, kind of, because we get to really be involved and feel a personal connection to the things. Cause you say, oh, you know, I had a piece in that.
I think Claire is really good at negotiating those relationships and making sure that the piece that comes out feels both like of a kind and like the designer. And I think that's a really hard balance to strike.
It's a really difficult thing to do. I briefly had a shop with Design Sponge, and it's difficult because the people you really admire, you don't want to push them too yes. much to do something, but it's that sweet spot in between your brand and theirs. Yeah. It's really difficult to negotiate. One thing I think you guys have done brilliantly is price point. And I really want to know how you deal with that, because I frankly don't spend a lot of money on mm-hmm. things. I'm somebody who writes about things and doesn't actually buy them, but I have really kind of crossed my price point really to buy jewelry, especially from Caitlin Motion. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with what you're comfortable with charging for things?
I appreciate you saying that so much, because it's one of the biggest struggles of our business. It is a challenge to sell things online, and it's a challenge to sell things from people who don't necessarily have a known name online. And it is about, I think the one thing we always say to designers is, can you think of it as a gateway drug pricing? Someone who's never heard of you before and never touched your stuff, and they really love what it is, but if they don't have the chance to hold it in person, they might spend $100, but they're probably not going to spend $150. But if you give it to them for $100 now and they own it and they love it and all their friends go crazy over it, then they're going to come back and spend not just $150, but $200, and they're going to keep coming back. And so, I mean, in all aspects, not just pricing, we always ask designers to think of it as a marketing effort and not really a retail thing. And, you know, don't think of this like you would about selling to Bird or any sort of, you know, other boutique. This is really a marketing exercise, and so pricing influences that so much.
And I think in the very beginning we thought it was all about the price point, and we thought that, okay, things under $100 just move really well for us. You know, $80 is like our sweet spot. But we quickly learned that it's actually very much about the value proposition. And there are a couple of pieces that have done really well for us lately, including the Motion earrings, that, you know, they just offer a lot for the price point. This Veda jacket that we did, that's denim and leather, we were kind of worried about it, but they sold out in a day.
It, you know, if something photographs really well, if you can offer materials, our customer, you know, is really conscious of materials, and that makes total sense, because our customer is the same one who wants to know how the thing is made, right? And so the fact that they care whether it's black diamonds or gold versus brass makes a lot of sense, and so that's played into it a lot.
Well, I think your customer probably appreciates things at a ton of different levels. I think one of the things that's most important to me is that you guys run your business in terms of customer service really well. I've honestly never written an email to a business before to say, like, good job. But I think one of you wrote me at some point to say, thanks for mentioning something. And I wrote back and said, I just have to tell you how great your customer service is, because when I order something, it's there a couple days later. And I feel like I've become an evangelist of a kind at this point, because it's very rare to find an online business, which typically runs pretty efficiently, that runs as efficiently as yours does. I mean, how important was customer service to you?
Really? Oh, like, super important.
There's a lot of talking about it in the beginning.
We modeled our customer service on the customer service of Zingerman's, do you know, in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is like an amazing
bakery.
Food store. They have like 5 businesses now. They have an amazing book called Zingerman's Guide to Great Customer Service, and we completely ripped that off. And I think it's basically about, you know, there are like 5 points that you're supposed to like acknowledge. If something goes wrong, you like acknowledge that you made a mistake, you empathize, and then you say, like, what can we do to make this right?
And I think something else that I really love about our customer service is that our voice from the website stays consistent with our customer service. And Erica cultivated this very identifiable voice for us that it runs through all of our customer service emails. And even the automated shipping confirmation you get, you know, sounds like us. And as a result, we get these emails from people who want to return stuff and they're addressed to Claire and Erica. And if people want to complain about something, they address it to Claire and Erica, which of course is good and
sometimes
bad because
it's our feelings. Yeah. But
it's also nice when they want to say something nice and it's addressed to Claire and Erica.
I think it's good. I think it ultimately makes people think twice about when they say something, though, because it's easier to be angry with like a faceless company than it is to really know the two people. I mean, you've done that really successfully, like you do with the designers. Mm-hmm. People feel like they know you in the same way they feel like they know the designers that you're introducing them to every week. And that's not something that every business takes the time to do.
It's funny. Yeah, we didn't know, I think, in the beginning that that was going to be a thing. And we had this very ad hoc little customer round table like a month after we launched with five people who'd purchased two or more things in New York. And that was sort of a thread that kept coming up that actually we want to know more about you. And actually, we like that you're part of the site and navigating how to do that without it feeling very like
it's still something we talk about a lot, like how do you don't want to shove yourself in the business too much. It's not a personal blog, but at the same time, yeah, it is a personal project and you want to strike the right balance.
Exactly. Well, I think you guys have done a lot of things right, but I would like to know if you've done anything you would have done differently at this point. Are there any mistakes that we can all learn from?
This is always a hard one for us because I'll pat ourselves on the back and say I think we're pretty good at treating mistakes as lessons, and so we never spend too much time you know, sitting around hating ourselves.
We came up with something recently that we were like, next time we should say.
Oh, right. Well, one thing we did that was really dumb that we used recently and for the same answer was that in the beginning we had a counter on the site that showed how many of everything was left because we were really supremely naive and said, oh, stuff is going to go so fast and people will want to know that there's only two left. And turns out it's really hard to sell $300 bunny bags online. And so there were just too many of them left. And we had friends and family members being like, oh, I saw you sold another one. And you're like, oh, my
like,
God, this
do
is so
all
stressful.
You're single-handedly peddling them on the street one by one.
Yeah. I think, you know, another thing that comes back to in our face a lot is that we don't have any really core members of the team who are very technical, and that's a really big challenge. We just launched a redesign, which unexpectedly I think was one of the hardest things we've ever had to do on the website, and because we didn't have anyone technical on our core team, and it was so grueling. And obviously we weren't the ones sitting there coding it, but just managing the people who were was really challenging.
Don't feel bad. Redesigns are always miserable. Amy and I know all about that.
Thank you. That feels really good because the wound is still fresh.
I've never met anybody who was like, that redesign was painless.
Well, the
do it again.
Thing was when that we had an amazing design company called Hard Candy Shell, who I were so grateful to have do the design, the redesign, and they handed us the mocks, you know, said this is what it's going to look like. And I remember looking at Erica and being like, I can't believe it's this easy.
This is done.
I can't believe our website is going to look like these Photoshop pictures. And then, yeah, it wasn't that easy. It was 6 months later that they finally are now living on ofakind.com.
And one of the really exciting things, though, like the sort of counterpoint to that, is we've been really lucky to have people rally around the business who have just felt really passionate about it, including, you know, tech developers who you're like, really? You are a 30-something-year-old man in Florida with a wife and a child, and you feel really strongly about what we do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's amazing.
Who one time when we were concerned about whether or not we'd be able to pay him offered to trade us style consultation, which he felt he was desperately in need of for hours programming. Yeah,
that's fantastic. Yeah, I know. Well, we only have a few minutes left, so I want to throw a couple more things at you. First, and most importantly, what are the pieces from Of a Kind that you guys wear on a regular basis?
This Dream Collective cuff I always wear by Catherine Bentley. I think it's so gorgeous. It's brass with orange enamel in it, and she hand carved the casts, and I just think it goes with everything.
And I wear, there are like three pairs of a kind earrings that I kind of wear every day. So the Motion earrings, which I wear in one ear, and they're a mismatched stud. So one is like a little diamond with no black diamonds, and the other has black diamonds. And the ones that Grace has, too.
I wear them every day now.
Yes. And then I have Blanca Monroe's Gomez studs. I wear one of each, the black diamond and the cognac, in my other ear. And then I carry our Thomas IV ECAT bag every day, too.
Nice. So before we go, I want to know what's next for you guys. What are sort of your plans for expanding, and who are some designers you're hoping to work with in the future?
Our next big step, which is almost scary to say because it's such a big undertaking, is we're launching a marketplace on the site so that designers can sell directly to customers and take advantage of our editorial content and our traffic. And the idea behind that stems very much from the founding idea, which is we wanted to support designers. And we found in the last year and a half that when designers do their own e-commerce, it can be critically huge for their business in terms of profit and exposure. And so that's the next big thing for us.
And in terms of designers, I'm really excited that we're working with Melissa Coker of Wren, who was the very first designer we ever talked to about Of a Kind. She got on like a conference call with us, and like I had written about her for a story for Ready Made, and she got on the phone with us and like talked it out, and we're working with her, which is amazing.
That's great. Well, it's all come full circle for you guys. Exactly. Well, congratulations. Thank you being here. And thank you for sending beautiful things to my door every couple of weeks.
Hey, thanks for asking for them.
So you guys can visit and shop Of a Kind at ofakind.com. Thanks to Erica, Claire, Lindsay, and Amy for being here today. And we'll see you guys next Monday at 12. You can listen online at heritageradionetwork.org or on iTunes. And we'll see you next Monday with Genevieve Gorder.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.